Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder that is joining us. You know, she is a powerhouse. You know, we're going to be talking about raising money. You know, on their end, you know, they've done, you know, quite a bit. You know, all in all, you know, if you aggregate everything, we're talking about $400 million. They are actually, you know, riding this rocket ship where we're going to be talking to about how to think about building a product that really, you know, covers a gap in the market, how to think about scale, as well as how to think about not just commercial when you're thinking about building a business, but then also about doing good for the world. So again, the building, financing, scaling, and all of the above is something that we're going to be covering today, which we love to hear. And brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Maheen Rahman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
So originally born in Pakistan, Maheen, but you were raised everywhere. So how was life growing up for you? Give us a walk through memory lane.
Sure. So I was born here in Pakistan, in Lahore, but I grew up effectively, I think, in the UK. And I also spent a little bit of time in Africa, which was interesting. So I think by the time I graduated high school, I had done about 6 different schools. So naturally sort of got very good at getting to know people quickly. And then maintaining those friendships and relationships through life, which I think is kind of the best part of switching so many different schools and growing up that way. So yes, I moved back to Pakistan in 2005, and I've been here since. So it's been about 20 years now, and it's been a very interesting ride.
So one thing there that is really interesting to what you just mentioned is you were in, I think by the time that you were graduating, you know, you were probably already in 7 prior schools, and that is new places, new friends, new everything. How do you think that the experience of jumping from one place to the next really shaped who you are, and then also how you're able to be with uncertainty?
I think it helped me realize that change is a constant in life, and you can't get too attached to certain ways of doing things or places or people, and I think embrace change. And I think that's what I learned very early on, I think as a child, that, you know, if I was going to be shifting schools and people and countries every 3 years, then naturally I was going to have to adapt pretty quickly and realize that change is really something that leads to growth. And I think that's something that's actually carried me all through life, is kind of embracing that change rather than resisting it.
And what about finance? What caught your eye on about finance?
So that's an interesting story. So I think way back, I think I must have been grade 11 or grade 12 or something like that. I read a book called Liar's Poker. And it was a big sort of hit at the time among the Wall Street types. And it was all about the 1980s and Wall Street and, you know, how the mortgage market was developing, how the bond market, the stock market was developing. And I just found that absolutely fascinating. So within that was kind of born this desire to learn more about finance. And so I went to college, studied more about it. And I think for me, it was a no-brainer once I graduated college that this is where I wanted to build my career. So that's where I started.
And obviously, in your case, too, you decided to go into corporate, no? And, you know, to kind of like join some of those bigger operations, such as like Merrill Lynch, mm-hmm. ABN, Amro Bank. How was it like experiencing those larger shops?
I think your grounding in terms of your understanding of finance is developed exceptionally well by these large institutions. I think Merrill sent me on a training course, which was over 3 months. And then they really do grill you. I mean, I've done the 18-hour days. I've done the all-nighters. I've done that investment banking routine way back in sort of the early 2000s. And I do think that, you know, that skill set, which I learned at that time at Merrill, at ABN AMRO, really has held me up through life. I mean, you know, that grounding has been intense, but it has been exceptional in terms of my understanding of how finance truly works. And, you know, we all say that it just looks very daunting from the outside, but, you know, on the inside, it really isn't rocket science. It's about, you know, using techniques and tools within the financial sphere to just do different sort of things for you. So I often sort of tell people that, you know, this is not a rocket science, or this is not daunting. You should really learn the basics of finance, and then you can pretty much apply it everywhere in life.
So for you, eventually you ended up joining IGI funds, but it was more of a restructuring type of initiative for you. I mean, and then after that, you went through an acquisition, no? But restructuring, how difficult is to do a restructuring?
Very hard. So this was an asset management company that had burned through about 40% of its baseline equity. And, you know, the sponsors, the shareholders, they were not happy with their previous CEO. So I got the opportunity at a very young age. I mean, I was just 30 to take over an asset management company that was running deep, deep losses. And I took it as a challenge because, you know, let's face it, at 32, you can afford to make some mistakes. I mean, what's the worst that could have happened to me at that point in time if I hadn't succeeded? So getting into this was back in 2009. So you have to understand, we were just coming out of the global financial crisis. Asset management everywhere was taking a beating, right? Markets everywhere had struggled. So restoring investor confidence was really hard. And then at the same time, you had an asset management company that was just running losses. So we went through a very difficult restructuring cycle that took about 6 to 12 months, in which we had to let go of almost 70% of the workforce. And that, I think, was the hardest part, because you're dealing with people, and you're dealing with, you know, people that have been with the company perhaps, you know, a long time. But, you know, once we got through that difficult year, we were able to restructure the company. We were able to give better investment returns to our, you know, investors and shareholders. And then come 2013, we were acquired by a much larger group. So, you know, the return to profitability took us about 15 months. And then we had already an offer on the table because the sponsors were looking to sell out. So we had an offer on the table for the company within, I would say, 36 months of me taking over. And so, you know, we were able to sell out and be acquired by much larger shareholders and a much larger financial group at the time.
So then in this case, you know, for you, I mean, ultimately the company got acquired. And I guess going through an acquisition, what is that like?
So it's tough. The thing is, with an acquisition, you know, it was a requirement of the business. So if you look at it dispassionately, if you're a small asset manager, you don't have met much in terms of distribution, you're really just doing very small scale institutional business, after a while, your growth is going to get stunted. And, you know, some people are happy to go with that. I mean, you have asset managers that sit on very small amounts of money, $50 million, $100 million, $200 million. But that's not the real fun, right? The real fun in asset management is getting to size and scale, because that's when you get taken seriously by larger investors. You know, you have many more opportunities in terms of distribution. So this company, IGI Funds, which I was part of, needed to shift its shareholding structure away from sort of family-owned sort of groups towards large-scale financial institutions that had the breadth and the width and distribution capability to take the firm to another level. And so the merger just made absolute sense. I mean, you know, Al Falah was a much larger group. It also had a struggling asset management company. And so when they made a bid for this, the merger just, you know, worked from the financial perspective. But naturally, it was obviously going to be really hard to bring together two companies. And I think that's what my job was initially in the first year or two, to see which people would be retained, you know, how the systems would be integrated. I mean, just a basic thing of where we're going to sit as a unified force, you know, which office do we sit in, right? And those were sort of decisions we had to make from ground up. So really, it's like recreating an entirely new company from, you know, sort of from two different entities that now have to be brought together. The other thing that really impacts you during these changes is culture. Because you can have two different sets of people and two different sets of employees, both with very different cultural mindsets and very different ideas of how each institution is. So I think unifying and finding a new culture that was born from both institutions, that was also a big primary focus. And I'm very happy that we succeeded. And within, I think, a year and a half to 2 years of the merger, we really were on very smooth sailing as far as a lot of the issues were concerned.
And then from there, you go into Al Falah too, where you became the chief executive. And
right.
This was ultimately the immediate step before you became a co-founder, I mean, an entrepreneur yourself, no, with the Infra Summit. So what were the sequences of events that needed to happen? Because, I mean, at this point, you were in the corporate world for quite a bit, you know, since mm-hmm. the late 90s. So, I mean, it's obviously risky to become an entrepreneur. So what pushed you in that direction, given that everything that you knew was just being in corporate and being an employee?
So I think the interesting thing is that after a while, I did 12 years of asset management, 12 years of raising funds, of creating that I was creating a large institution. I felt I had done pretty much everything that I came to do at Alfala. I had certain personal goals for myself. I managed to achieve them. I had certain targets. And I think by the end of it, I was looking for what next, right? And I was approached by the sponsors of InfraZamin, and they came with a very unique proposition, right? They came with an idea of impact finance. And I think that's what interested me. But naturally, the shift was very risky. I was going from a institution with over 250 people, which I was heading, which was part of a massive financial group, into a pretty unknown sort of brand, which was really just sort of appealing to me on a very basic idea. And that basic idea was, how do we ensure access to finance in developing markets where finance is so difficult to obtain, right? And I think that was the sort of, you know, it just kind of ignited that interest in me that can this work? Can this access to finance piece work? And the more I sort of talked to them, and this was the Private Infrastructure Development Group, which is based out of the UK, the more the idea began to really appeal. And I think I was sort of interested anyway in seeing how we could do development finance. And here was a really interesting and unique way to create opportunities for others who were interested in starting their own businesses, others who were interested in large-scale private sector infrastructure projects, to raise money from the local domestic capital markets, which sort of at the moment were just kind of a sort of playground of the very large business groups. So we were kind of fighting for the little guy. We were fighting for the guy who was not going to get access to that kind of capital without us. And I think that's where the idea just grabbed me. And so as a result of those conversations, I agreed to leave, you know, a job that I really enjoyed at Alfala, but to kind of take that challenge and move into a field which was new, completely brand new in terms of the scale and the size and whatever we were trying to achieve, and see how I could do it. So I did start off really at being the first employee. So I was the company secretary, I was the CFO, I was the, you know, marketing head, I was a distributor. So, you know, at the end of the day, I went from being, you know, a very high-end sort of CEO into a business which really had to be built from absolute ground zero. I'm very happy to say that the last three-year journey has been incredibly rewarding so far.
Hey, guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out. So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of InfraZamin?
Right. So what we do is we provide credit guarantees. We provide guarantee solutions to the private sector, to companies. which can't find that financing elsewhere. So for example, Alejandro needs to go to a bank. He needs money to set up a new project or a new manufacturing line, or even just put a solar panels on his rooftop. He can't seem to get the bank to listen to him because the bank is like, hey, we don't know you. We don't understand your risk. Or we just consider you too risky to lend to. So this is where InfraZamin comes in. So Alejandro approaches InfraZamin and he says, can you give me a credit guarantee which I can take to the bank? And suppose we like the project, we do our due diligence, we run the numbers on it, and we give you a credit guarantee which you can take to the bank, and you know they will lend against our collateral or our guarantee as opposed to you. So actually the bank, you know, we're taking the risk and we're taking your risk onto our balance sheet and allowing the bank that comfort so that they can lend to you. So we've just unlocked a piece of lending or piece of capital access which may not have happened in the past without us. So that's the kind of catalytic impact that we want to bring into markets like this. And in the last 3 years, we have actually demonstrated that in some really interesting transactions.
And also talk about fundraising too, because I mean, you have all been quite successful there. And also that's a piece of what you do. So how much capital all in all have you raised, and what is the breakdown too of that?
Yeah, so the company started with about $50 million of capital. We are able to now leverage that to issue $400 million of guarantees in the market already. We are looking to see how we can raise additional capital next year. But for now, I think our balance sheet is quite steady, quite strong. We further have alliances with various other sort of institutions to do grant financing. So we do also do grant financing as well for, you know, sort of capacity building in the markets or to bring down transaction costs. I mean, a lot of the time, sometimes, you know, companies come to us and they don't want to bear the cost of transactions. So we actually raise that grant financing to bring down overall transaction costs for companies as well. So we try and see where we can fit in combinations of grant, combinations of equity, and then leverage our balance sheet to really stretch our capital. I mean, you imagine yourself with just $50 million of equity, we are able to do $400 million of guarantee issuance, right? So that gives us a lot of size and scope, and this keeps multiplying. So the way we are structured, an additional sort of, say, $50 million would double our capacity to do more guarantee frameworks. That's just the way we structured the entire capital base. So, you know, our advice to sort of entrepreneurs is kind of think outside the box. You know, everything does not need to be equity. Equity takes away from your own ownership. So look at other forms of lending that are available to you. I think in the US, the market is incredibly developed and advanced in terms of looking at venture debt or looking at debt instruments, etc. But in other parts of the world, that is a challenge. But I think you can use, you know, don't reinvent the wheel, just to see what's been done elsewhere and try and replicate aspects of that in terms of what makes sense for your own structure.
And then also, as part of the business now, how have you guys been thinking about scale?
So in terms of scale, what we want to do is bring transactions that can then be replicated and push forward that scale themselves. So what does that mean? That means that if we've got a company that has come to us, used a guarantee, raised money in the market, the next time around, they may not need the full guarantee framework and they could just do it themselves. So for us, scale is not necessarily us doing all the business, but it's kind of enabling banks to recognize risk and price it and do it without the guarantee in the future. And so that way we've kind of unlocked a whole new segment of lending. One example of how we've done that is in solar. All right. So if you look at solar projects, I think 5 years ago, and we have a sister company called Grandco. 5 years ago, I don't think anyone really did distributed solar financing, which is sort of your rooftop solar. I think two transactions later, we are now seeing banks willing to lend themselves to such projects, meaning that not only have we done those two projects, but we've now enabled a whole other range of projects to come to market without the guarantee. So for us, the catalytic and scaling impact is really around opening up market channels for new sectors and new technology. And that's how we're demonstrating it so far.
And then now let's put aside the whole scale and the commercial side of thing of any business, right? What about going a step above that and also thinking in parallel about doing good for the world. What does that look like for you all?
Yeah, so everything we do has to carry development impact. And I'll give you an example of how we enabled this here in Pakistan just last year. So we had a microfinance institution here. I don't know if you follow Pakistan, but in 2022, we got hit with some really bad floods. You know, displaced like 33 million people, destroyed like 5 million homes. It was an exceptionally bad sort of disaster from the climate perspective, right? Now, in terms of rebuilding, that rebuilding takes a long time. But what we did is we created a structure or a bond, right, that was launched in the capital market last year with a microfinance institution, which would then lend or use the funds from that bond that would lend exclusively just to women to reconstruct sort of flood damaged homes, rebuild schools, you know, and refurbish businesses that had been damaged. And so provide that livelihood across the board, right? And we call that a gender bond. So we actually ended up launching through the guarantee the first gender bond out of South Asia, which is quite a sort of unique, you know, sort of instrument that we created. And we were supposed to, we did this to demonstrate market impact and to demonstrate how, you know, funds could be raised through capital markets and bond markets as well, right? But the development impact was so interesting. It was supposed to impact about 30,000 women. I think to date, and we are just shy of about a year of the bond's launch, we've already impacted about 18,000 women in sort of low income segments. And about 15% of that bond proceed has gone towards house reconstruction, all of which were damaged in the flood. The remainder has gone to upgrade sort of schooling facilities, etc. So, you know, we try and build in development impact at every layer. And that for me personally was an incredibly sort of rewarding aspect of the job, because anyone can put together structured finance, anyone can put together project finance, but how do you layer in development impact, ESG, climate, all these sort of nuances which are so topical today, and how do you get mainstream commercial investors to invest in such projects without compromising their returns? And I think that's what we managed to do with the gender bond, and we look to replicate that now across various different sectors as well. So it's finance innovation as well as development finance, which I think has been a really nice marriage throughout the story of InfraZamin.
So then talk to us too about if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of InfraZamin is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, it would look like a place where InfraZamin should be out of a job, because we've done our bit in terms of catalyzing the market and getting the market to recognize risk and lend to sectors which normally wouldn't get it. That kind of world would have open access to finance for all sorts of innovation, all sorts of industry, would enable domestic institutions, local banks, local capital markets to lend long-term to infrastructure financing, such as bridges, water plants, et cetera, so on and so forth. So really a world where financing is available for very difficult projects and is available in a very sort of open and risk-aware manner. And that would be kind of the ideal, right? That's what we aspire to, that kind of access to finance for everyone.
So let's say now, kind of like return, like in a time machine. Let's say I put you into a time machine and we're going to be able to go back in time. And let's say I put you into a time machine that brings you back to, let's say, 2020 or 2021, where you were thinking about maybe building something of your own. And you're able to have a chat with that younger self, your younger self, Mahin that is a few years earlier. And let's say you're able to give that younger Mahin one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Oh, that's a good question. I would just tell that younger Mahin, keep going. Don't stop. You're on the right track. Because I think when you're trying to do something brand new, there's too much doubt. There's too much doubt. There's too much fear. There's the fear of the unknown. And I think the first year was quite tough. It was hard to set everything up. But yeah, I would just tell her now, don't stop. Keep going. It is going to work. It is going to come together. And you shouldn't be afraid. And take that risk. And I think that's really what would have been enough.
So I think I mentioned this to you earlier. I'm a girl's dad. And I have three girls that, you know, they're quite entrepreneurial too. You know, they do their lemonade stands and all of that stuff. I do believe that the world needs more female founders. And I know that eventually, you know, they would love to get out there and make a difference, you know, in a similar way, hopefully, you know, to the way that you're doing it. What kind of advice do you have for all the female founders, all the ladies out there that are thinking about taking ownership of their own destiny?
Just do it. I think you can overthink this to kingdom come. You can talk about the risks and the challenges to kingdom come, but ultimately you have a passion for something. Don't lose that and just go with it. I really don't want to say more than that. The reality is that you can bomb, but the reality is you can also do really well and you learn by doing. But if you don't ever do anything, you're never going to learn. So just go for it. I mean, if that's a passion, just follow it. You'll find your dream. I mean, I have three daughters myself, so I'm a girl mom. And, you know, my focus in life has been just to encourage them on every opportunity they wish to take. So as a girl dad, and as to all the little girls out there, I would say just do it. There's nothing really to stop you other than yourself.
I love it. So Maheen, for the people that are listening out there, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
No, shoot me an email. I do respond, but LinkedIn is usually a good way to find me.
Amazing. Well, Maheen, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you. It has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.